I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. You would think, since we live with ourselves 24/7, that we would know our values, our talents, our goals, our inner desires, and we would understand our effect on others and how they see us. Turns out that being self-aware is a rare thing, and that can have a big impact on our choices in life and our sense of well-being, including our happiness. Our guest, Tasha Urich, is an organizational psychologist, wrote a book called Insight about how to develop internal and external self-awareness, and she joins us on Radio Times. Tasha Urich, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is psychologist David Dunning on why incompetent people are so often overestimate their skills. The reason is something called the Dunning-Kruger effect, and he's here to tell us how this works. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan, emeritus professor at Cornell University. He studies misbelief, decision-making, distorted judgment, and why people believe things that are not true, and he joins us from the studios of Cornell University. David Dunning, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
A pleasure to be here.
Well, let me begin with a really basic question, and Tasha, I'll toss this to you first. Why are we so bad about knowing ourselves?
There are so many factors, but they can really be broken down into two categories. One of them are the barriers that exist inside of us, and Professor Dunning has devoted much of his career to studying that. Essentially, we can't access so many of our unconscious thoughts and feelings and desires, and we tend to be pretty blind about what we're thinking and what our level of expertise is, what we feel, even how we behave. But then on the other side of the coin are the societal or external barriers that are in front of almost all of us every day. I always say that the world is tempting us to become more self-absorbed and less self-aware, and this cult of self is preventing us from seeing ourselves objectively. And P.S., it's not just millennials that do this. There's evidence that things like social media, for example, the self-esteem movement, are making us all more self-deluded.
Do you think we're more self-deluded, David Dunning?
Yes, because I'd actually add a third source, potentially, of being self-deluded, which is that we're active agents in it. We practice self-deception. We do what's referred to as motivated reasoning. And so often what we do is we distort the information that we have, that the world is telling us, to believe that we are better off, that we're stronger, that we're better, that we're faster, that we're taller than we really are.
And why do we do that?
It's an interesting question because it isn't necessarily something that you can find the world over, but it is simply more pleasant, if you will, to think good things about yourself. It certainly produces less anxiety to believe pleasant things about yourself and your station in the world than to believe unpleasant things. And so not everybody does this, not everybody around the world does this, but if you take a look, for example, in the United States, Tasha's right, a major problem we have are the barriers that are out there to letting us know about ourselves. But beyond that, sometimes we're active agents in our own deception.
Well, let me go back to you, Tasha. Why then, and you've done some interesting studies about why we, most of us, think we're pretty self-aware, but as both of you were saying, we tend to be wrong about this. Why do we overestimate our self-awareness?
I think it goes back to what Professor Dunning just said, is it feels far better for us to believe we're self-aware and indeed to rail against others for their lack of self-awareness than it does to turn the mirror, the attention to ourselves. And our research has shown, at a high level at least, that 95% of people, if you ask them whether they're self-aware, they will agree with you, whereas the real number, the closer number of people that are actually, that we can consider self-aware, is closer to 10 to 15%. And so the joke I always make is, on a good day, that means that 80% of us are lying to ourselves about whether we're lying to ourselves. And it's pretty scary.
Well, are they always right about us?
And that's a really important question. It's important not to swing too far to the other direction. Our research has found that there are basically two overall categories of self-awareness. There's something we call internal self-awareness, which is seeing ourselves clearly, knowing what we value, what we want to accomplish, you know, what our behavioral patterns are, our impact on others. But then the other side of the coin is knowing how other people see us. But what we've discovered from, research with thousands of people around the world is the most self-aware people balance those two types of self-awareness. And interestingly, they're not related to each other. So there are a lot of people who are high on one but low on the other. But the true benefits, as far as we can tell from an empirical perspective, are when you develop both types of self-knowledge and you balance them.
And I do want to get to that. But let me first turn to you, David Dunning. So what is the Dunning-Kruger effect? How does that work?
The Dunning-Kruger effect, as it's popularly known, is the fact that people who lack expertise, they're unknowledgeable, for lack of a better term, you could call them incompetent, simply are too incompetent to know they're incompetent. That is, to know you're incompetent takes expertise. It takes the exact same expertise you need to actually make right decisions. So if you're making a lot of wrong decisions, basically you lack the very expertise you need to be able to recognize that you lack expertise. And so people who are poor performers are simply, it's not that they deny that they're poor performers. This is not an act of self-deception. They're just not in a position to know that they're poor performers.
Because they don't have the kind of insight to realize that they're poor performers?
Well, it's not basically what happens is this depends on specific areas of competence, being a good parent, being a good public speaker, being a good statistician, and so forth. In those specific areas, if you don't have expertise, you don't have the expertise not only to become good, but you don't have the expertise to be able to judge what's good. And because everybody does what they think is the most reasonable, they're left with the impression that they're pretty good, even in those situations where they're not good at all.
Are they a lost cause then?
No. Some may be, because down in that area of incompetence or poor performers, you have an entire zoo of different types of individuals. Some people just lack training, and with training they'd be able to recognize the error of their ways, they'd be able to correct the errors that they're making. Other people might actually have a little self-deception mixed in, so you can't tell them, quote-unquote. Often I talk to educators about a syndrome known as the resistant student, for example. And they may be a lost cause, but their core problem is something different. And you might have people who just don't have the cognitive resources to be able to do better. So are people, when they're poor performers, a lost cause? It depends on the specifics. Some may be, but when we've looked at people who are performing poorly, a lot of them, it's just simply they had no idea there was a better performance to be had. They just have to have their consciousness raised, so to speak, about what excellence really looks like.
It reminds you of something that Donald Rumsfeld infamously said about the known knowns, the known unknowns, and then the unknown unknowns. Is that what you're talking about?
That's absolutely a grand swath of what we're talking about, that people simply don't know what they don't know. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I should mention that in some sense, the human mind is an amazing instrument. One statistic I like to quote is that by the time you're age 60, you will, if you're an average English speaker, know 48,000 different words. That's terrific, except that there are over 600,000 words currently in the Oxford English Dictionary. So we know a lot. But there's a lot out there that we don't know, and what we really don't have an insight into is the scope of all that ignorance and the geography of all that ignorance of what we don't know. So that's part of it. The other part of it is, and I think we Tasha may talk about this further, and this is something we should note, is that even though people are not necessarily aware, they're aware of something.
Right.
And once you're aware of something, it's hard for a person to realize that something might be false.
Tasha, let me turn to you and picking up on the Dunning-Kruger effect, the fact that we often don't know how bad we are at something. Where do we find these people? Do they gravitate to certain positions or certain jobs or certain fields?
There is a disturbing amount of evidence, actually, that the more power a person has, whether it's, you know, a volunteer organization, certainly a business, any organization of people where certain people are in charge, when you have more power, you are less likely to be self-aware. There was one study that looked at senior executives compared to middle managers or frontline supervisors, and they found that the higher up the researchers went into the organization, the more likely they were to find people, leaders, who overestimated themselves on everything like empathy to coaching to communication skills, and yes, including self-awareness. So there's a lot of reasons that this is the case, and my belief is you don't necessarily start out as any less self-aware, but especially if you're in a position of power, we sort of have these assumptions in our mind. One of them is, well, I must be doing something right because I got here. I got this promotion that most people don't have. Another factor is that it gets harder and harder for people to tell us the truth when we're in you know, more powerful positions. And there's a lot of factors, but the sum total effect of that is you are the least likely to be self-aware if you are very, very powerful and visible in your organization.
Because if someone tells the boss, essentially, you're not very good at this, you could be in deep trouble.
That is what I would call a career-limiting move, indeed.
To say something like that. Do you want to weigh in on that, David Dunning?
Oh, yes. I just wanted to say that's absolutely right. Not only are people in power potentially less aware of themselves, they're actually less aware or accurate about other people because they stop caring so much about being right or being careful in the impressions that they form of their underlings, for example. Now, if you're an underling, you're very concerned about what your boss thinks of you, and so you have every incentive in the world to get yourself right and to get your boss right. The boss may not have that incentive.
Well, Tasha, I'm just picking up on what you said about the higher up in power positions, the less self-aware you are. Does a then successful leader ask for feedback if people are not willing to give it, will, you know, give it without being asked?
As counterintuitive as that sounds,
yeah.
I believe, you know, and I've been an organizational psychologist for the last 15 years, I have never seen a situation where an executive or leader has asked for feedback and not benefited in some way.
Really?
There's, you know, sort of this perception, I think, for many people that if I ask someone how I can do better, it will communicate weakness. But the opposite is actually the case. So there's been some research, for example, that 87% of top-performing leaders regularly ask for critical feedback versus just 17% of the poorest-performing leaders. So as hard as it is, you know, sort of emotionally and practically, leaders who do ask for that feedback from all around them are socially rewarded.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Tasha Urich. She is an organizational psychologist, as she just said. She wrote a book called Insight, and it's subtitled Why We're Not as Self-Aware as We Think and How Seeing Ourselves Clearly Helps Us Succeed at Work and in Life. Also with us is David Dunning, and he's a psychologist as well, professor of psychology, I should say, at the University of Michigan, also emeritus professor at Cornell University, and he studies things like misbelief and decision-making and distorted judgment. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more to talk after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with two psychologists, Tasha Urich and David Dunning, about how to be more self-aware and the dangers of self-delusion. David, let me go to you. Why are we then so much better judging other people than ourselves? And both of you have said it's important to get feedback from people around us. That helps us understand who we are and how we are perceived, but why are we so much better judging others than ourselves?
Well, there's a number of reasons that all conspire to make us potentially more accurate about other people than ourselves. The first is getting other people right is an important task in life. And one would think that getting yourself right is also an important task, and it is, but it's attended with a lot of other tasks as well. That is, we want to maintain our motivation, we want to think well of ourselves, we want to avoid anxiety and so forth. And so this task of getting a person right gets swept up with all these other things that people are concerned about. The other thing that helps us to become more accurate about other people is we just see how they behave. We see how they act. We just see it, period. And in some sense, we never see ourselves act. When we act, there are always a number of asterisks or footnotes that we can attach to our behavior. So maybe we act a little selfishly today. Well, I'm having a bad day, and I really need that money, and blah, 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 blah. But we attach a little asterisk to our own behavior, which actually may obscure from ourselves the type of person we are, the type of way that we're going to behave. Whereas for other people, we see the raw data, if you will, and we don't interpret it in misleading ways.
Tasha, let me ask you about shy people. I think shy people are often misperceived as being unfriendly, maybe even arrogant. So in terms of self-awareness, as we apply it to shy people, again, who's right and who's wrong, and how do we understand that?
That's a really great question. I think that's an example where our clarity about ourselves can be something that we share with others. I always tell my coaching clients, nobody knows your intentions. People see your behavior, they see your decisions, but they don't always know, the reason that you're doing those things. And so what I would recommend for someone who is more introverted, which, by the way, I put myself in that category, is to just be a little bit more open about that. You know, to say something like, you might not hear me talk the most in this meeting, but I really will promise you that if I have something that I feel is important, I'll put it on the table. Or, I tend to be quieter in large groups of people. And that's where, again, the power of self-awareness occurs when we see ourselves clearly. In that case, we know our patterns to be more introverted or more shy, and we also appreciate how other people might see that behavior. We're able to take their perspective and almost, there's a psychologist named William Ury who talks about seeing ourselves from the balcony, this objective view of how we're behaving as much as possible, given some of the limitations that Professor Dunning discussed. So I don't think that's insurmountable if we're honest with ourselves and we're honest with others.
And asking, I guess, for feedback, David Dunning.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Because often we really don't know how our behavior is being perceived by other people, and it can be quite informative to find out that you thought you were being stern and the other person thought you were just being moody. But that works both ways, that if we can become skilled at giving feedback to other people, we may be able to improve their lives a little bit by letting them know how they're being perceived.
You tell a story, Tasha, in your book about a woman named Teresa who gives you some feedback about your behavior. Can you talk about that?
Yes. It's the self-awareness researcher being the first student of self-awareness.
Exactly. No, and I appreciated your honesty here, but go ahead.
Yeah, none of us are immune. So this was literally when I was working on our five-year research program of self-awareness, writing my book, and I was out with my husband and several of our friends that he had known longer than I had because they were originally his friends. And my friend Teresa, after several lip-loosening cocktails, kind of slid up beside me in a bar and looked at me and she said, "Tasha, we're so glad we have you in our lives." And I just had this moment of, oh, my gosh, this is so wonderful.
I'm so great.
But then she continued. She said, "And boy, have you come a long way since we first met you." And then pause. And I had no idea what she was talking about. I was sitting there on the stool in the bar in the middle of the self-awareness research program, and I had absolutely no idea where that was coming from, what I had done to earn that title of someone who had come such a long way.
What was she telling you? Yeah.
I discussed it with my husband on the way home. I was sitting in the driver's seat. He was in the passenger seat, and I told him what Teresa had said. And, of course, there was dead silence on the other end of the car. And eventually he said, she's not wrong. Huh? And I learned that some of my behavior when I was a young upstart, brand new PhD unleashed into the world, that I was behaving in a somewhat high maintenance or self-aggrandizing way. And it was such a good data point. And I tell that story a lot for one simple reason. these people, including my husband, are the people that I'm the closest to in the whole world. And the fact that nobody said anything to me for 10 years was really quite stunning. But it goes back to a lot of the research that Professor Dunning and I look at every day. People have trouble telling each other the truth. If we don't ask for feedback, we won't usually get it unless we're doing something especially egregious. So to me, that's just a testament to how important it is to take to take ownership of our own journey.
And David, as Tasha writes, having an honest critic or a group of honest critics in our lives to give us the kind of feedback that we might not be aware of.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, one of the things, if you're in this business, you come to realize is just how lackluster we are as a feedback-giving and feedback-receiving culture. We're not very good at giving feedback to other people, and we're not very good at receiving feedback. In the late 1990s, there was a terribly important review article that looked at 100 years of feedback interventions that had been used in various organizations, various businesses, and found that 40% of them actually demotivated people by giving feedback as opposed to motivated people, which just tells you how far we have to go to become skilled at both giving feedback, but I'd also add receiving feedback. Mm-hmm. One last note. We just found some worldwide data looking at eighth graders, and do they have an accurate vision or impression of their math and science skills? And we found in some countries they do. Other countries, no. Poor performers fall prey to the Dunning-Kruger effect. But in those countries where the kids knew when they needed to work on their math and science, the key characteristic of those countries was that teachers were willing to give feedback and give negative feedback if necessary.
How do you do that? I mean, how do you do that without raising the kind of defensiveness that we often feel when someone says, you know, you kind of fell short here?
Well, the first thing is you don't wait. That is, often people will give you very necessary feedback, but they'll only do it after they've finally gotten mad about it. And if a person's shouting and screaming at you, that's not a good situation to receive the feedback that the other person is trying to tell you. So if feedback can be given more often, more frequently, can be given with suggestions about how to change behavior, concentrates on behavior and not the character of the person. All these things are pointers that make it easier for a person to hear feedback and also makes it easier to give feedback. But the key is not waiting until you're in a situation where you can't stand it anymore to give feedback, or you put it in a situation that is going to raise a person's defensiveness. Namely, you're giving them feedback at the session in which you're going to tell them what their merit pay is going to be, what their pay raise is going to be for the year. You have to separate those things from each other.
Ouch. Let me read an email from Sue. I'll put this to you, Tasha. She says, I've been told I'm very self-aware because I tend to be self-deprecating about my challenges. People say half the battle is knowing what is true. I'm 54 so far. All that self-awareness has gotten me nowhere. But is self-consciousness or even self-deprecation, is that self-awareness?
Sue, thank you for that question. The short answer is no. There is this concept, and I'm asked this question very often when I speak about this topic, is it possible to be too self-aware? And what people are usually talking about there is self-consciousness or even sometimes underestimating themselves. And I think it's important for us to take a step back and realize there are different ways that a lack of self-awareness can play out. One of them, which is most common, is that we overestimate ourselves. But just as important, and slightly less often, but still damaging, is when we don't really understand what we're contributing, or we're overly self-conscious even though we're performing well. So for those people, what I typically say is, think about ways that you can increase your self-awareness by increasing your understanding of what you're doing well. So instead of going up to someone and doing something that I call the dinner of truth, which is to ask them what they find most annoying about you, it's a different question. The right question is, why are you friends with me? Or what have you seen me do that was so effective that you don't think I've seen myself? And, you know, just one more point about this idea of self-acceptance. In our research, we found that truly self-aware people are also high in self-acceptance. And that means that they have a full and fairly objective picture of who they are and what they bring to the world, and they are willing to love themselves anyway. And I think there's a certain power about that. I talk about self-acceptance and self-awareness as two twin pillars. If you have one without the other, you're going to be in trouble. If I accept myself without really seeing myself clearly, I'm going to be delusional. But if I see myself clearly and I don't accept that person, that's going to have negative consequences on my well-being. So that's something I think that's important for all of us to remember.
David, this is such a small example, but I know several people who will, let's say, make a beautiful cake for someone's birthday. And when we say, oh my God, this is so good, they'll say, oh, but I had trouble with the icing, or it's not level, or I ran out of X, Y, and Z and I had to substitute something else. Seems like a small example, but it's also their unwillingness to accept a compliment.
Well, I think that's right. Or to accept, let's say, another person's point of view, or to give as much credence to what this cake looks like to another person, to the outside, to the social world, as it looks like to me. And I think if we're more accepting, just in general, about what other people say about us, both the good and the bad, that could be a tremendous aid in us finally learning about ourselves and who we really are.
Here's an email from Wayne. He says, if I consider myself to be lazy, undisciplined, easily bored, impatient, and easily distracted, does that mean I'm likely self-aware? If one is more critical of oneself generally, does that indicate self-awareness? Kind of a variation on what we were just talking about. But I guess being self-critical is important. But I guess when does that, Tasha, sort of move into the problem of not accepting oneself?
Yeah, and I would maybe just build off of what we talked about for Sue's question. One thought is to ask yourself, am I really being objective, or am I potentially being overly critical? And there's a fine line there, because going back to what we talked about earlier, there's very rarely one truth. You know, my truth or your truth, there's some kind of interplay between those two things. But one specific tool I might suggest for people who are worried if they're being self-critical is, you know, whatever's going on in your inner monologue. If you say, oh gosh, you know, I just, no matter what I do, I just can't do this well. To take a step back and ask yourself, would I say what I just said to myself to someone that I love and respect? And quite often, at least, you know, for me personally, even that helps me get out of that cycle of, you know, researchers call it rumination. Sometimes we get so fixated on the negative parts of ourselves that we almost get sucked into a rabbit hole. And what we know is what people who have those thought patterns tend to be more depressed, more anxious, more stressed. They have, you know, less well-being. They're less successful at work. And so I think stopping those patterns can be a very important part of seeing ourselves clearly.
In fact, you say rumination is introspection's evil twin.
Exactly. And what's weird about it is it feels very often like productive self-reflection. And I don't know how much time we'll have to get into this today, but there's a lot of research showing that the way very many people introspect is actually wrong. That's one example where we're beating ourselves up for something we said in a meeting, when really the best introspective question is, what did I learn from this? And maybe what could I do differently? And forcing ourselves to move forward with that insight rather than being stuck on it.
In fact, you say think what, not why. The why is not as productive as what.
That's it. And we found this largely based off of our research. We interviewed people who did not start off as self-aware, but who through the events in their lives and their own commitment became highly self-aware, as rated by themselves and others. And we found that they almost never ask themselves, you know, why did I say that? Or why do I feel this way? You know, or why is that person so upset with me? They asked what questions that were pushing them forward. So, you know, what's my part in this challenge or this argument that I'm having? What could I do differently in the future? You know, what are the excuses I'm making that I need to stop making? And the difference there, it's subtle, but it's very powerful. Why questions trap us in the past. They keep us emotional. They keep us from having personal agency. And then what questions move us forward? They help us be more objective, more action-oriented. So it's a powerful difference.
David, let me segue from what we've been talking about into a more public affairs and the media and how we think about facts and the news. We've been talking about the Dunning-Kruger effect. We've been talking about just how we don't know ourselves. How does that feed into the fact that there are so many people in this country that cannot agree on a fact?
That's a very interesting question, because if you take a look at controversies right now in the United States in the political realm, often it's not the controversy is not about a priority. It's not about values. It's not about where you want to take the country. It's now controversies about fact. That is, are we, for example, at an all-time high in teenage pregnancies, or are we at a decades low? The answer is yes to one of those two things. Did the stock market go up or did it go down under the Obama administration? Majorities of Democrats and Republicans will answer that question in different ways. And it is an issue because if you cannot agree on the facts of the country you're debating, it's hard to figure out how exactly you're going to come to some resolution of the debate. And so that's actually a topic that our lab is looking at, that a lot of labs are now looking at across the country, asking how do you get people to move from the debates we seem to be having right now, which are quite fractious, to the debates or the arguments we should be having about priorities and values heading into the future. That is, how do we get people to agree on facts? And we're only at the beginning of understanding why people disagree on the facts so much as we stand today.
Well, especially if we don't know what we don't know, and that leads to kind of aggrandizement of what we think we do know.
That's absolutely right. And the one thing that we do know is there is a little motivated reasoning or distorted reasoning coming in that pushes people not only to have certain opinions, but to have certain beliefs about facts. And so what we've been trying to do is figure out how do you forestall that so that you have a better chance of agreement all the way around.
That's David Dunning, our guest, one of two guests on Radio Times. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan, also emeritus professor at Cornell University, joining us from the studios of Cornell. And he studies things like misbelief and decision-making and distorted judgment. He's also the Dunning of the Dunning-Kruger effect, which we have been talking about. Tasha Urich is an organizational psychologist, wrote a book called Insight about how to develop internal and external self-awareness. Talking about self-awareness today on Radio Times. Again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Comments coming in, radiotimes at whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or put a comment on our Facebook page. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Just a recap here. We all know someone who overestimates themselves, or perhaps they're oblivious to their actions, how they affect other people. A study found that something like 95% of people think that they are self-aware, when in fact only 10 to 15% are truly self-aware. Talking with Tasha Urich, who's the author of that study, and David Dunning, both of them psychologists. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. David Dunning, we have a David with an email question. Why is it that creative artists, poets, singers, painters who create universally beautiful stuff are often very difficult people? Do you feel comfortable answering that question?
Well, I have two different answers. Okay. The first answer is the premise may be false.
Okay.
That is,
enough.
We remember the ones who are difficult. And so they weigh heavy in our mind, but we forget the Dvoraks of the world who are just wonderful, happy people, despite the fact that they were world-class composers. The other side of it may be that it's like being the boss. It's another version of being the boss, which is if a person does have a supreme talent, if it's talent we don't want to disturb, we might not give that person the feedback or treat that person in such a way that'll cause them to quell their difficulty. So unfortunately, I can't answer the question except by answering it two different ways.
Can you answer it another way, Tasha?
No, I would agree with that. I think that's very, very fair.
You have talked, Asha, about sort of inner and outer self-awareness. And I do want to talk about, so moving beyond the sort of the what's and the whys, how do you suggest people build on understanding themselves better, especially their impact on other people?
Mm-hmm. So I mentioned, and we're talking very specific tools and approaches here, but earlier I mentioned something called the Dinner of Truth, which is actually an exercise that was developed by a communications professor, Josh Meisner, where he has had, you know, for at least the last 10 years, every one of his communication students sit someone down in their lives who they want to strengthen their relationship with. It could be a significant other, a friend, a colleague, and ask them the question, what do I do that's most annoying to you? Hmm. And sort of imagining that conversation, hearing them and asking questions and trying to understand. And then after the conversation, making a, you know, as objective as possible decision, what do I want to do with that? And I would never ask my clients or my readers to do something that I hadn't tried multiple times myself. And at least as it comes to learning how others see me, that exercise has been one of the most powerful, simple approaches that I've ever used. And it's interesting, you know, you sort of expect that you'll have some kind of a conversation where it's an indictment of you as a person. You know, we fear, our worst fear is our friend says, well, I never really liked you in the first place. But that almost never happens. What usually happens almost always is they give you a very specific data point that you can decide what you want to do with. So, you know, one time I did this, I asked a good friend of mine that question. He said, well, to put it simply, I love you in person, but I hate you on social media.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, wow, you know, that hurts a little bit, but
sure.
What I loved about it was that it was specific, and it put me in the driver's seat. I would have maybe never known that about how he saw me until I asked him the question. And I did make some changes, you know, at least my personal social media accounts. How do I navigate that just like we all do? So I think in terms of getting feedback, what's important is to be specific. I tend to discourage people from walking up to someone, you know, that they want to hear their perspective and just saying something general like, hey, how am I doing? Sometimes, you know, a boss might do that and then say, well, I asked someone for feedback. I can check that box. But what we found is very rarely do those questions give us good, actionable information. So even in general, if you're not ready to do the dinner of truth, I'd encourage people to think about what are the skills or talents or competencies that are important to you? What are the things you need to be able to do successfully to succeed in your job and in your life? And ask about those questions. You know, for example, I'm a public speaker. That's how I spend a lot of my working time. So why not ask people specifically, what did you like about that last speech that I did? What could I improve next time? So as much as we can anchor those feedback requests in something specific, the better feedback we'll get, and often the less personally devastating it will be.
Well, interestingly, and just picking up what Tasha said when she asked people, what is the most annoying thing about me? I felt my anxiety going up. I mean, I think that's it's a really pointed and powerful question.
And, well, it's funny because readers send me these wonderful emails of, I tried this and here's what happened.
Yeah.
I can tell you, I've learned when I hear people tell me about their experience, I'm just thinking of one woman who wrote me recently. She said she did this with her 8-year-old son. And what he said was, Mommy, I'm really worried that you're not taking enough time for yourself, that you're doing so many things for our family that you're not looking after your own well-being. You know, and obviously he said it more in an 8-year-old kind of fashion. But she said, and I'm crying as I'm writing this because I hadn't really seen that perspective mm-hmm. before. And it took my son, the person that I love the most in the entire world, to hold that mirror up to me. So pretty much anything is possible in those conversations.
Sure. And that's the village, I guess, David, you know, the village that we need to tell us the truth about ourselves.
Well, that's right. I mean, self-insight really, it does take a village to provide self-insight. And one of the things I like about this activity that Tasha suggests is I'm sure it's nerve-wracking the first time you do it. And I assume it's less nerve-wracking. It's ever not going to be not nerve-wracking, but it's something that becomes easier to do as you do it again and again and again. That is, the issue that we have with feedback is that it's something we do so rarely in our day-to-day life, either give it or receive it, actual substantive feedback, that it becomes a big event. And to the extent it can become an ordinary event, I think we'd be much more adept at it.
A bunch of questions here. One from Jennifer from Allentown. Is there a difference in self-awareness when it comes to gender? David, if I can toss that to you, have you observed it matters if it's a man or a woman?
Well, yes, it does, but it also depends on what specifically you're talking about. That is, there are some areas in life that are male-identified, sports, for example, and other parts of life that are female-identified. And what we find in our own work is that each gender will be overconfident in those areas that are their gender is identified with. So there's no general trend for men to be overconfident or underconfident, or for women to be overconfident or underconfident. It really depends on the task you have in front of them.
And I guess the stereotypic way we think of those tasks.
That's absolutely right. It's bound up in the gender and the gender stereotypes that we have.
An email from Sarah. I'm going to toss this to you, Tasha. She says, does self-awareness correlate with narcissism?
Yes, negatively, thank goodness. It's interesting with narcissism because it's very easy to make that a counterpoint to self-awareness, right? If someone is narcissistic, they have an overly inflated sense of their own contributions, a lot of other psychopathology going on there, but just in general, as it relates to self-awareness, we found that there is a very, very strong negative correlation between narcissism and seeing yourself clearly. There are a couple of interesting studies that show that narcissists have something called pseudo-insight. And what that means is they're typically aware that something is non-optimal in their relationships. But what they typically do is they blame it on the other people. You know, they say, oh, this person is just too dim to appreciate my brilliance, and that's why things aren't going well in this relationship. It's a little bit more complicated than on the face of it, but in general, yes, the more narcissistic we are, the less self-aware we tend to be.
You want to add to that, David?
Yes, I just wanted to add that I should note, however, that in some sense we do like narcissists, however. That is, we tend to make them bosses. We tend to elect them to political office. So that narcissists who desperately seek these sorts of positions sometimes have a little bit of evidence on their side as to why they deserve the positions they have or the impressions that they have about themselves. Narcissists are not necessarily universally disliked.
Oh, because they have, what, big personalities, big egos?
They're exciting.
They're
that
exciting.
Is, I think if you take a look at the literature on CEOs, heads of companies, what narcissism tends to do is it tends to create a situation where the CEO is going to take the company on a ride. Now, the ride may have a happy ending. The ride may have an unhappy ending. But times are going to be exciting. More on average than if it's a non-narcissistic CEO who has been elevated to the head of the company. So, and some people absolutely enjoy the excitement.
Can we apply this to our political system? I mean, you need a big ego to run for president.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And if you take a look at both American presidents and you take a look at prime ministers of England, they tend to be high on narcissism. And not only the bad ones, but the good ones. For example, Winston Churchill, what I've read, observationally was very high in narcissism. He was also very high in depressiveness, by the way. But he was considered the man of the half century by Time magazine in the 20th century, or the first half. But he definitely displayed narcissistic tendencies.
So is that a healthy narcissist, or is that going too far?
I think, once again, it's a match between the person and the situation that they're in. And if you take a look at what happened with Winston Churchill, this was a man who was voted into and out of office several times. And he was voted into office when he was needed, when the country was at war. But he was not the greatest prime minister when the country turned to peace.
Let me read an email from Robert. He said, could your guest speak about the potential of meditation in building self-awareness, especially as related to being aware of our thoughts? Tasha, you write a bit about meditation and mindfulness in your book.
That is, it's a growing area of research. So we don't know everything about self-awareness as it relates to mindfulness, but we are seeing evidence that people who practice mindfulness and meditation specifically tend to be more self-aware. And if you even take a step back and think about what is mindfulness beyond even just meditation, and by the way, there are lots of ways to practice mindfulness without meditating. Mm-hmm. But when we think about that, it's really just tracking our thoughts, being aware of them, understanding what they are, but not necessarily overthinking them, right? So we talked about rumination earlier. Rumination is getting stuck on something, unnecessarily analyzing it in ways that don't promote our well-being or our self-insight. Whereas mindfulness, might be something as simple as I have an argument with my husband and I say, wow, I'm really upset right now. What do I want to do about that? Just that identifying of the emotion itself. There's been a lot of research actually that shows that decreases the fight or flight response part of our brain, our amygdala. It prevents it from taking us over in that moment. So I'm very pro meditation. I think it's a very exciting area of study as it relates to self-awareness. But there's also ways, as I mentioned, that you can practice mindfulness without meditating. So one tool that we've found in our research that you can use is comparing and contrasting. So for example, let's say I'm in my job and I'm noticing that I am very unhappy. You know, more days I'm going to work and I'm dreading going there than being excited. So a question I might ask myself to compare and contrast might be, if I think about the other jobs I've had, what's different about them? Maybe if I've had a job where I got excited to go to work, what was different between my job now and that job? And basically what you're doing is you're just looking at the facts, at least as much as we can, rather than getting stuck into a hole of you know, oh gosh, why am I so happy and unhappy in this job? What am I going to do? But it's really just noticing. And there's a professor, Ellen Langer, who does amazing work on meditation and mindfulness. And she says mindfulness is the process of actively noticing new things. And I think that's really powerful.
David, do you think there's a connection between self-awareness and empathy?
I believe there is a connection in at least making the attempt at empathy, for example. That is, you want to take a look at things through different perspectives. And sometimes those perspectives may prompt empathy. Sometimes they may not prompt empathy. But you, for example, if you are taking on a task, you may want to ask, how does this task how would it look through the eyes of another person that you know, for example? Or if I did this task and I did it well, what does that mean? If I did this task and I did it poorly, what does that mean? So I'm not sure at the end of the day you come up with empathy. You may very well come up with empathy. But what you definitely want to do is you do want to not rest with one perspective, but you want to take on different perspectives when you're looking at a task that might be of some import.
We're almost out of time here, but David, I'm curious about your interest in this whole large, sprawling field.
Oh, what prompted it?
Yeah.
When I was in graduate school, I noticed that there were days I felt I was the smartest person here. And the next day, I would feel that I was the stupidest person here being the particular graduate school that I was in. And I was interested in two things. First, how could my impression of myself fluctuate so much? But second, when it fluctuated so much, how did that day's perspective feel so real, like this is the way things really, really are? And so I became interested in what fed into people's beliefs about themselves, simply because mine were so incoherent.
Well, that's a terrific explanation, and I really appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. David Dunning, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And he is the Dunning of the Dunning-Kruger Effect, also a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan, emeritus professor at Cornell University. He joined us from the studios of Cornell. And Tasha Urich, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. She is an organizational psychologist, and she wrote a book called Insight. We appreciate those comments and questions to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Bob Ball's the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.